Committee on Rules. Love to have a little sunshine, but the Oregon weather has decided not to bless us this morning with it. We're going to change. I need everyone to be a little flexible in terms of the agenda. If folks have scheduling commitments and need to get out of the room, if you'd send notes up to staff and let us know, that would be extremely helpful. I would like to inform, unless folks are in the room screaming, I do not want to have a hearing on House Bill 2389. Is anybody demanding that I hear the bill? I am not going to move it. All right, we're going to take that off the agenda. You guys go have a cup of coffee and have a lovely morning. Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on 2754. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill? Senator Whitsitt, do you have some friends that you want to bring up?
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. House Bill 2754A creates the Oregon Center for Health Professions within the Department of Higher Education, and that program would be administered by the Oregon Institute of Technology.
All right. Thank you very much, and good morning.
Good morning.
Take it away.
Thank you, Chair Brown, and committee members for the opportunity to testify on 2754 today. For the record, I'm Senator Doug Whitsitt, representing District 28. Colleagues, never in our history has a greater demand existed for allied health care professionals. Our population is aging, and we as baby boomers reach retirement age and beyond. This demand will increase at near exponential proportions. The demand for allied health professionals will parallel this exponential expansion. OIT is currently our state leader in the education of these allied health care professionals. The school currently offers nursing, dental hygiene, nutrition, ultrasonography, nuclear imaging, vascular imaging and technology, radiology, magnetic resolution imaging, CAT scan technology, and many other different programs. Each program is constrained by the same common denominators. Each program has several times as many qualified applicants as the program has capacity to educate. And each program has several times as many requests for graduating students as the school has the capacity to produce. OIT has completed a building design, has established industry partners, and is developing an innovative private sector funding initiative to position itself to fill this gaping void in our state's ability to educate our needed allied health care professionals. OIT President Martha Ann Dow has recognized the need, developed a staff of expertise, and has demonstrated the desire and the ability to lead this state in the education of allied health care professionals. Oregon Institute of Technology is the logical choice. Creating the Oregon Center for Healthcare Professions at OIT is the first giant step in the right direction. I urge you to move this bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. You must be Ms. Hansel?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Denise Hansel. I'm the director for the Center for Health Professions at the Oregon Institute of Technology, and I've had over 25 years in the healthcare industry and understand from a hands-on experience what the need of workforce is in the industry. So I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 2754 and to respond to any questions of the bill. This bill passed with unanimous support from the Oregon House of Representatives earlier in the session. The Oregon Institute of Technology, as Senator Whitsitt has shared with you, has over 50 years of experience graduating allied health care professionals in the state of Oregon. This expertise, combined with critical need for health care professions in Oregon, set the stage for this legislation. There is no funding to this bill, but the potential to help OIT meet its goals is tremendous. House Bill 2754, including the amendments, designates OIT as the leading Oregon resource for these educational programs.
I need some health care.
Need some health care.
Right.
Claritin. And gives us a significant credibility as we pursue other avenues of funding. As Senator Whitsitt mentioned, we do have a detailed plan to how address the workforce shortage in the next 5 years through the center. Our plan has been 3 years in the making and is based on strengthening the development of partnerships with other educational institutions, with leaders in the healthcare industry, and with manufacturers of high-tech medical equipment. OIT takes seriously its mission to provide this kind of education for Oregon, and this is why this bill is so important to us. Currently, OIT is the only public university in Oregon that offers these bachelor's programs in dental hygiene, medical imaging, including radiologic science, nuclear medicine, sonography, and vascular technology. While these programs are offered in Klamath Falls, the dental hygiene program is also offered in partnership with the Oregon Dental Service in La Grande, Oregon, and many of the programs offer bachelor degree completion programs through distance learning. And OHSU's nursing program is also delivered at OIT in Klamath. Through partnerships with other institutions, OIT also offers joint degrees with OHSU in clinical lab science and emergency medical technology disciplines in Portland, and most recently developed a respiratory care program with Rogue Community College in Medford. While there exists a need for qualified allied health personnel and workforce, educational institutions lack the capacity, labs, equipment, faculty to provide for this need. And as Senator Whitsitt mentioned, OIT turned away 300 qualified students last year because of lack of capacity. As Oregon's leader in providing public bachelor-level allied health education, OIT will continue to partner with institutions across the state to ensure that there's sufficient workforce personnel to serve both the urban and the rural areas. Our plan is to double the number of bachelor's degree graduates in these programs by 2010. We'll be working with community colleges to address the shortage and continue to develop our partnerships to ensure that the high-quality educational services are distributed cost-effectively in both urban and rural areas. Another important part of our plan is transferability. We're committed to developing a seamless transition to these programs between the community colleges and the universities, and we'll continue to develop our collaborative effort with OHSU and integrate OIT's recognized expertise in hardware and software engineering and information technology into the health technologies. Oregon Institute of Technology is proud of its tradition of excellence, its success in graduates, and the relationships we maintain with the industry to meet the needs of the workforce. We are extremely thankful to Representative Bill Garrard, Representative George Gilman, and Senator Doug Whitsitt for sponsoring the bill that would give OIT the additional credibility as we pursue our business plan. We have developed a network of industry and educational partners who are serving as advisors and who are supportive of this measure, including the Oregon Community Colleges Association, OHSU, the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and the Governor's Workforce, Healthcare Workforce Initiative. I thank you for this opportunity to present this information, and I urge you to approve House Bill 2754. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Garrard, take it away.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Committee, good morning. I'm just here to support this bill and to support OIT. This bill is a first step toward preparing Oregon for the medical needs of the future, and this is a great first step, and I'm very proud of OIT in taking the role of leading in the allied health workforce development for this state, and I would ask your support. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. I have Ms. Jo Bell. Can I just note for the record that you all are in support? You've got written testimony. Great. Bring it up. All right. Anybody else wishing to testify? Good. We'll close the public hearing. Open a work session. Senator Atkinson.
Madam Chair, I would move the bill to the floor with the due pass for recommendation.
Senator Atkinson has moved House Bill 2754 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none. So ordered. Senator Whitsitt, we'd really appreciate it if you'd carry it on the Senate floor. Thank you very much. Okay. Any other legislators?
Thanks.
Thanks in the room. I think we're okay.
Thanks for shopping.
All right, we're going to move back up to executive appointments. Would Mr. Jobe from the Oregon Tourism Commission and the two folks from the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board come on up? One? We've just got one? Okay. Ms. Westbrook, why don't you come on up? We're going to do this a little odd, but we don't have lots of bodies in the room, so we're opening a public hearing on the Oregon Tourism Commission, the executive appointments, and the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board executive appointments. Mr. Jobe, Tourism Commission, tell us a little bit about yourself and why you want an appointment to this commission.
Thank you very much, Madam Brown. My name is Jeff Jobe. For the record, I am the general manager of the Heathman Hotel, and I have been serving as a hospitality professional in Oregon for over 8 years now, and I'm very excited at the opportunity to further promote the state as a unit in the hospitality and tourism industry. Our goal at the commission is to encourage economic growth and to enhance the quality of life in Oregon through tourism, and I believe that I have a nice vision and a good working relationship throughout the state, which would be beneficial to the state.
Great. And we also appreciate at least the restaurant very much. Some of us don't get to spend the evenings down there very often. But any questions for Mr. Job? Senator Farrelly.
I'm going to meet with
the downtown core of the city of Portland is a wonderful magnet for tourism. But there's an awful lot of diversity in the state. And I just wondered if I could hear the applicant talk about rodeos.
Sure. Mr. Job, tell us what you know about rodeos.
Well, being from Oklahoma and having grown up with the backyard of the national finals and never missing one until it moved, unfortunately, to Las Vegas, I can speak very much about rodeos, especially Malala, St. Paul, or the Pendleton Roundup.
Y'all are going to do fine, Sean.
Thank you very much. You hit it right on the head.
I love the depth of these hearings.
Sir Shields, any questions?
After that?
I think you're going to be fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're not going to move into work session today. We've been holding our executive appointments for a week just to make sure that there's no information, there's not information out there that we don't have access to. And if there's any problems, we'll give you a call.
Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Close the public hearing on the Oregon Tourism Commission and open a public hearing on the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. Ms. Westbrook, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and why you'd like to serve on this particular board?
Good morning, Chair Brown and Senators. My name is Helen Westbrook. I live right now on the North Fork of the Nehalem. Recently spent about 15 years in Cannon Beach. I'm a native Oregonian, born and raised in Prineville. I have a strong interest in the economic, environmental, aesthetic, and recreational values of our watersheds, and particularly an interest in the connectivity of our watersheds to the ocean shore. I am also very interested in the economic investment benefits that OWEB has throughout the state of Oregon, particularly in the small rural communities. I'm currently serving my second term as a Clatsop County Commissioner.
Okay, great. Thank you. Questions? Sarah Shields.
Second term in Clatsop County Commission?
That's correct, Senator.
Okay.
I was just clarifying. Appreciate your background. Do you think you can handle some of the tough things that kind of get thrown at the Watershed Enhancement Board now and then? It's not always the most popular board in the state.
Chair Brown and Senator Shields, if you'd ever been a Clatsop County Commissioner.
Sounds like my question is as well-founded as Senator Farrelly's was a minute ago.
Yes, sir.
I think you answered the question.
Thank you.
All right. Any further questions for Commissioner Westbrook? Thank you very much. We really appreciate you joining us, and we appreciate your willingness to serve on this particular board. As Senator Shields mentioned, this is it has been through trials and tribulations, so we appreciate it. Senator Shields.
But I want to add, you've got friends, thank you for taking the appointment.
Over the last couple of years, I've developed good relations with the co-chairs of this particular board. So Ms. O'Keefe participated on an urban rural program with me. So I've just really enjoyed getting to know her. So I think you're in good hands. So
Thank you for your time.
All right. That was close the public hearing on the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. Everyone else is via phone, correct? Mr. Peek
and Green.
Okay. All right. We are calling. I'm going to open a public hearing on the Commission for Women, the appointment of Ms. Ellie McPeak. Anybody else in the audience wishing to testify on any of these executive appointments? She's at the Ashland Springs Hotel. Senator Atkinson, is that familiar? Is that the big yellow one? That's great. This fabulous hotel. Maybe.
Maybe I'll talk to her.
Okay.
Hi, thank you for calling the Pearland Hotel.
I must have dialed the wrong number. Let's try again. Okay, let's try one more time. You do have a phone system in Ashland, don't you, Senator Atkinson? That's the one I just
dialed. We've had electricity now for 3 years. Got the phones worked out.
We're looking for the Ashland Springs Hotel. We apparently have the wrong number. Are you connected?
No, we're not.
Okay. Thank you.
Good luck.
Bye-bye.
She's really there. She's at the restaurant? Okay.
We'll come back.
All right. Okay. Thanks. Let's close the public hearing on the Commission for Women, open public hearing on the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. I think I need a one on this one. You don't know the number off the top of your head, do you, Senator Atkinson?
Hello.
Hi, is this Mr. Nakano?
Yes.
Is it Nakano?
Nakano.
Okay. Good morning. Welcome. You are in front of the Senate Rules Committee. I'm Kate Brown, and we have all of our committee members here, Senator Frank Shields, Senator Ted Ferrioli, myself, Senator Charlie Ringo, and Senator Jason Atkinson. You are on speakerphone and being taped throughout the building, so just want to warn you of that. We'd like to hear from you this morning about why you'd like to serve on this particular board and why you think your background qualifies you for such service. And we want to say we really appreciate your willingness to serve.
Okay. Well, the reason that I would like to serve is, you know, I've been involved with, well, it originally started with GWEB and there.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I was involved in the early 90s with GWEB, and then after it turned over to OWEB, I've been involved with OWEB all these years. And I've been taking an active role. I was one of the first recipients of the Governor Kitzhaber Spirit of the Oregon Plan Leadership Award. And, you know, it's the funding that we've been getting from OWEB is making the watershed in the state of Oregon much healthier. And this is the first state agency that's been able to actually do this. And we've been working diligently for the last, you know, 15 years or so, getting the watershed, the healthy watersheds, with not only with for the fish, but the clean water act and everything. And I'd like to see this continue. That's the reason why I put my name in the hat.
Great. Thank you. Any further questions from the committee? Not a soul. Senator Ringo, nothing? Okay. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate your willingness to serve on this board, and we have started a newer process in the State Senate of asking new appointees to come forward either via phone or in person so that we can get a better sense of the citizens who are serving on our boards and commissions and so that you can get a better sense of our legislative process. So we really appreciate your willingness to join us by phone this morning, and just very grateful you're willing to serve the state of Oregon. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, that was easy. All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, and while we look for Ms. McPeak's phone number, I'm going to
open a public hearing on the following commissions: Commission for the Blind, Construction Contractors Board, State Board of Direct Entry Midwifery, Outdoor Youth Program Advisory Board, Oregon Patient Safety Commission Board of Directors, Board on Public Safety Standards and Training, Oregon Transportation Commissions, and Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. Anyone wishing to testify on any of those commissions or on the governor's reappointments? Okay, seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on those reappointments. Let's go to House Bill 3127. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us a little bit about the bill, and Ms. Flicker, why don't you bring your folks up?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. House Bill 3127 modifies the statutory definition of business under the Oregon Government Standards and Practices Laws to exclude certain nonprofit corporations. We have -1 amendments to this bill, and the Rural Electric Cooperative can discuss those amendments.
Great. Thank you. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Madam Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sandy Flicker, and I represent the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. And first, I want to thank you and Ms. Harris very much for the opportunity to have this hearing and hopefully move this bill on its way. We will be very, very brief this morning. This is a bill sponsored by Representative Bob Jensen. And Sean, his staff person, is here to make some comments. And then we will have Mr. Justin Burns, who is an attorney for Oregon Trail Electric Co-op, who will give some testimony on the reason for the bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians, legislative aide to State Representative Bob Jensen, House District 58. Much like Ms. Flicker said, we'll be quite brief here and leave it to our resident expert as far as explaining the bill. But just say Representative Jensen greatly appreciates the committee hearing this bill. He would have been here this morning himself, but unfortunately he's tied up with the Department of Forestry budget. Representative Jensen also supports the -1 amendments, which were worked out with Minority Leader Merkley over on the House. And with that, I turn it over to Justin Burns from Oregon Trail Electric.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. Justin Burns, appearing on behalf of Oregon Trail Electric Company. I, too, appreciate your courtesies this morning. To be very brief, Oregon Trail requested the bill to align the definition of a business, particularly to align the definition of nonprofit corporations for the purposes of the ethics statutes. This language proposed in this bill was part of the omnibus ethics legislation that passed last session and was vetoed on other grounds. There's no known opposition. There's no opposition from the Ethics Commission.
Opposition just walked in.
So we ask for your support and any questions if you may have
them. Questions from the panel?
There will be.
There will be.
First.
What bill is this?
House Bill 31.
No, I'm sorry. There is an amendment that we have under consideration also. Would you like to discuss the -1 amendments?
The -1 amendments were requested by Representative Merkley to clarify that the language of the bill only applies to directors on boards of nonprofits and not executive directors of nonprofits. We don't oppose that language and are happy to accept it.
And if memory serves, Representative Merkley is an executive director.
Correct.
I see. And I am an executive director.
Correct.
Madam Chair, we've discussed the -1 amendments and the bill.
And my recollection was the -1 amendments were extremely brief.
Only affecting the clarification that that we insert the word board directors rather than executive directors at the request of Representative Merkley of the House.
Great. Okay. Any further questions for the panel? This is a pretty quiet morning. We should do Thursday mornings more often. Thank you very much. Appreciate your willingness to join us this morning. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 3127? Okay, close the public hearing. No, open a work session. Senator Farioli.
Move the -1 amendments to House Bill 3127.
Senator Farioli has moved the -1 amendments to House Bill 3127. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none? So ordered. Senator Farriola.
Move House Bill 3127 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Senator Farriola has moved House Bill 3127 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection?
I object.
No, you don't.
Oh, well, with that stunning testimony all the way
okay.
from Justin Burns, I've decided to take all of my preconceived objections and waive them temporarily for an aye vote.
Great. Motion carries. Senator Nelson, want to carry this one?
Yeah, Nelson, me, it doesn't
okay.
matter.
Okay, all right. Senator Farriola, you or Senator Nelson can carry this bill. Okay. Okay, we have a number of legislators coming here. I assume you're here on 2840, 2840, 2840. Why don't you come on up?
Madam Chair, they're just here to observe.
No, they're
how
not.
How a well-run committee operates.
No, they're not. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2840. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us a little bit about this bill? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Brown.
Yes.
Come on.
Okay. I just miss my committee a lot, so, you know, I figured with George and Chuck here.
It's great.
Do you have a,
she would have been
do they have a quorum?
Probably, but we're in the Senate. Ms. Harris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2840A
Burger's not on the committee.
Is a revision of school zone speed statutes that were enacted in 2003.
I'll leave it at that. Besides, if they are, they're not violating the open meetings law because we are in the open.
Except it wasn't
the quorum problem right. is when you're
that's
not
right.
in the open.
Wasn't
the committee
you have to be posted, man. They weren't. Right. It wasn't posted. Yeah, exactly.
The bill hearing was posted. Okay.
Madam Chair, I was not on the Transportation Committee. I don't count here.
All right. You do count, but anyway. Representative Boone, why don't you go ahead and get started?
Clarification, Madam Chair. I don't count here.
Actually, I'm going to defer. So.
Okay. All right. Somebody take the microphone.
I will. I will start and then defer to the chair since
okay.
He's tired of me. Vicki Berger, for the record, I'm Vicki Berger, State Representative, District 20. As most in this building know, I sponsored legislation which would repeal totally the school zone law that we enacted 2 years ago. I did that. I have never seen, and I know you have experienced similar, such a constituent firestorm as was visited on me when that thing went into effect. And there were a couple of issues that my constituents were pretty clear on that bothered them the most. One was the inconsistency of what we did. They never knew, you know, what the speed zone was they were driving in, and then that would determine what they were supposed to do when they got near a school, and they always felt at a loss. And consistency in traffic laws is the key to getting good compliance. The other issue was the 24-hour thing. Driving by a school at 20 miles an hour in the middle of the night, in the middle of the summer, just about drove them wild. I never had any objection to the when children are present language, but others did. So when it came to a complete repeal, there were I didn't get what I wanted, but I will tell you that the chair of the Transportation Committee came up with a very good compromise that I can certainly support, and I will let him discuss what it is. I will also tell you that I have been very happy with ODOT's response throughout this, and the issue for me, the thing that will make school zones work in any event, and this is part of this proposal, is the flashing yellow lights. And in response to that, I will tell you that ODOT has been extremely proactive right away in getting flashing yellow lights out on the schools in the areas where, so I have a list here of all the new flashing yellow lights in school zones that ODOT has made it a priority to get started. So I will defer to the chair of the Transportation Committee to tell you what the proposal is. Thank you for your attention. Be available for questions and ask your passage of the bill as developed in the House.
Thank you, Representative Berger. Representative Gilman, good morning and welcome.
Thank you, Chair Brown. Appreciate the opportunity to appear before you. Our Transportation Committee did a job that should have taken us about 2 weeks, and it took us 4 months to come up with this legislation. And part of the reason is because we had a lot of different points of view expressed. And what we finally came up with was school zones 7 to 5, 5 days a week, and essentially school days. It may not be perfect. As a matter of fact, I don't think we do very many things in this building that's perfect. But it's a very good compromise. And it makes sense. And I think drivers out there will understand it and will still keep children safe. Representative Berger already talked about the flashing lights. As far as I'm concerned, they're the real answer. A flashing light in a school zone gives all the control back to that local school. If they want to turn those on at 6 in the morning, turn them off at 9, turn them back on at noon, whatever they want to do. If they want to turn them on Saturday because they have a function at that school, they can do that. So it gives the local community all the variable options that they deserve. And the cost of those things are coming down. It's a situation where a local Rotary Club or a Seroptimus Club could easily participate funding the installation of a flashing light. And of course we have a commitment from ODOT. You've already heard about installations already made. I feel very good about within 2 years, ODOT will have flashing lights on all school zones that are over 30 miles an hour. And those are the ones I think we should do first. And then if school districts in a 25-mile zone want to put a light in, that's probably going to have to be their responsibility. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Boone.
And I'm pretty much on cleanup here. We did have a field hearing in, Deborah Boone, House District 32. We had a field hearing in Bend earlier this year, and it was well attended. And there were all kinds of ideas, and we have worked hard on this, and our end product was a compromise, and it was an agreement pretty much across the board. People agreed. They liked what we came up with. So, and I think that Representative Gilman is absolutely correct about the flashing yellow lights. I got caught short down on one of the streets coming in kind of quickly this the other morning. And
did you ticket, Representative?
No, I did not, because I saw the flashing yellow lights, and I slowed down right away. I was only going a little bit over, but, you know, 20 is 20, and 25 is different. So
it is.
And everybody else slowed down, and I was all of a sudden pulling out in front of everybody, so I knew there was a reason they all dropped back. But it's what caught my eye, is what I'm trying to say, rather than trying to read the small print on all the different signs, but it was the flashing yellow light. So anyway, I'll give it back to Rep. Burley on the end to wrap it up.
Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Representative Chuck Burley, House District 54. I believe that what you've heard already is rather modest, in the sense that the hearings that we had, the viewpoints were so far across the spectrum. It was amazing. And I think that the Chair and others, by bringing this together, those in the working group, Representative Berger and others, did a great job coming up with a very good, reasonable compromise. And the only other thing I'd like to point out, Madam Chair, is that there's another bill, the Safe Routes to Schools bill, which is currently in the Senate Judiciary Committee. It's our opinion that if that program is in place, and if indeed the U.S. Congress passes the transportation bill that also authorizes Safe Routes to Schools and allows for appropriations, that some of those dollars may be used to help put in some of these flashing yellow lights as appropriate with a safe route to school.
Okay, thank you very much. And of course, at the word of federal dollars, my ears pick up every time. Question, Representative Berger, Representative Gilman. City of Portland has suggested that we go from, instead of the 5 o'clock, go from 7 to 7, 7 days a week. Your thoughts on that?
We discussed that. My objection is this. The purpose, people forget,
We spend a lot of our time in gridlock in our cars, and the purpose of our roads is to intelligently get us from here to there, not to stop us for no reason. From 5 to 7 is prime commuter time. It is not prime school time. I think it is a mistake to say to drivers, oh, well, there might be a child, and it's the head of the gridlock season, and we're going to slow you down further and confuse you more. That's why we stopped at 5, was simply grade schools are not active at that time of day at all, and I think all of us feel that that's where our sort of heart danger is. Also, I don't see any statistical evidence that we have some huge problem with an increase in accidents and problems around schools that ever started us down here. So let's not further frustrate drivers, because I think that causes as much problem as anything, by taking prime commute time and sort of arbitrarily saying, well, you might have to slow down because there might be a student. I got to tell you one personal story while I got the mic. You are looking at a woman who at age 12 was hit by a car. And I've thought a lot about cars and kids and people because I spent most of my teenage years in plaster or in surgery. You cannot legislate against craziness and irresponsibility. It will happen. And it's bad. And children do get hurt. I don't deny it. I've been told that I'm real cold-hearted. I don't care about kids in schools. Let me tell you, I care. I've experienced. I know what it's like. But it's an irresponsible driver that's going to get us in trouble. You're responsible drivers. You need to be reasonable to and reasonable for. So that's why I'm encouraging, don't go to 7 and don't go 24 hours. If schools, the flashing lights trump the time. So if schools have a special event and have invested in flashing lights, they can turn them on and alert the drivers. And that's why... the proposal, the big issue is when you're out on the highway and you're going 45 or 55 and suddenly there's a 20-mile-an-hour zone. That's where those lights and what ODOT is doing is really critically important. It says, there's a school coming. You better be down to 20 when those lights are flashing. In your local neighborhoods, folks know where the schools are. They know when the schools are in session. And responsible drivers will be responsible. Don't slow traffic from 5 to 7 just because, and that's how I see this.
Thank you.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the 7 days a week. And I understand that there are a lot of playgrounds and parks adjacent to schools. And there are children using that road or sidewalk or crosswalk to access those parks. But we don't see a great amount of statistical evidence that shows us that there's a big problem to be solved there. And the idea of going, most of these school zones in Portland that we seem to be talking about are, we're going to change it from 25 to 20. Well, that's not a very big change. But the thing is, you've got to remember out in our rural areas, we're talking about changing it from 35 or 40 to 20. And that's a huge difference. And we want to keep that. We want to do it whenever children are at risk, but we don't want to do it any more than we have to.
Thank you. This is not really a question, but more rhetorical. Now that you've been able to tackle this issue, I was hoping you'd been able to tackle the pedestrian crosswalk issue.
Senator, I can't tell you how many times when I've been talking to people about this, they say, and also take on that other thing. And my response is always, I only have the energy for one of these. I'm sorry.
Any other questions, Senator Ringo?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure I understand how you anticipate this working, that the local community, whether it's the city or the schools, could raise money to install the yellow flashing lights, and then they could be activated by the school personnel. Is that right?
And in the absence of the flashing lights, it's 7 to 5 school days, okay. 20 miles an hour. In other words, there's a We are still retaining the 20 miles an hour, but...
Understand. But for example, let's say there's a Saturday morning soccer game. Then somebody from the school could activate the flashing yellow lights. And in that event, then the speed is 20 miles an hour while the lights are flashing.
That's correct.
Are there guidelines on who can activate the yellow flashing lights?
No.
Representative Gilman, go ahead.
I'm sorry to say that'll probably be an issue for the next legislature, okay. As a matter of fact, because we're going to have flashing lights all over, and we're going to have some poor superintendent that forgot to turn the darn things off when he went home at 4:30, and that sort of issue. So, yes, there are some, as I say, no legislation is perfect. There are two things in this legislation that are a little troubling. School days, how does the public, the general public, know when a school day is, and who turns off the flashing lights and under what authority? But we don't have the answer to that.
I'm just curious why you didn't specify that school personnel have the authority. And partly, you know, I've got a couple of the amendments here, but I don't have my bill file, so maybe it is somewhere in this legislation. But I wanted to ask.
No, we kind of left that open. Representative Burley could probably speak better to it. I'm going to let him.
Oh, Representative Burley, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The yellow lights, I mean, obviously they're not new. We have them now. And in fact, I really commend the city of Salem for their investment in the lights, not only in the school zones, i.e. the roads that are specifically adjacent to the school, but also the crosswalks that are associated with a safe route to school that are several blocks away from the school grounds. And those lights right now, I'm presuming for the most part the ones I've seen here in the city of Salem, are on automatic timers. Now, I'm not the expert, I'm not the technician, but I certainly believe that those lights could also be operated manually quite simply if they wanted to. The question on who could turn that on and off never came up. I would be more than happy to defer that to the school districts, and they know who's got the keys.
Well, Madam Chair, just a comment. It just seems to me that, I mean, the bill needs to be fixed, no doubt about it, but there was a reason it was passed in the first place, and as you know, I mean, that's because schools are a place for kids in the evenings and on weekends, and the idea was that safety is needed even during those times. And it just seems to me that it's important to allow flexibility then, so that if that school is in operation in some way on a weekend, then you can clarify that those yellow lights can be activated.
That is part of this legislation. What we didn't delve into is who has the authority and what their restrictions are. I would also say that the bill distinguishes between school zones around schools and crosswalk school zones that may be three or four blocks away. And I've actually been pretty critical of ODOT in this, in that they don't distinguish for the drivers. When you're driving, you kind of see a school zone, and you're not sure whether it's a crosswalk school zone or there's a school right next to you until you get there. That being said, what we did was leave the "when children are present" language in the crosswalk issue, flashing lights and when children are present, because they're kind of two different things. You're talking about kids congregating around a school, but the routing is only during school hours and certain hours, and often those are on sort of arterial streets, and that's why they put them up. I will tell you that the city of Salem has invested $2.5 million in flashing yellow lights, about half of which are turned off under the current law.
Interesting.
Thank you, Senator Ringo.
I just wanted to ask a question about the Dash 6 amendments. And I just wondered, are we going to get any discussion of these? Mark Landauer is going to talk to us about this. Okay, you guys aren't going to talk to us about the Dash 6.
I guess, Senator Ringo, I just might sort of push back on us legislating who turns off the damn lights. I mean, I think we can leave that to the school district's discretion. I just don't think we need to have that conversation at this level.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't disagree with that. I just want to make sure that they know they have the authority. And as I said, it sounds like it's implicit in the legislation.
And every time I've talked to it, I've said that flashing lights trump. And maybe that's not understood by everyone, but that means, as far as I'm concerned, if that yellow light's on, I don't care what time it is, if it's midnight and that yellow light's on, it's 20 miles an hour.
Okay.
All right. Thank you all very much. Representative Gilman.
Chair Brown, I'm sorry. I don't know if you have amendment for emergency clause available to you, but that would be a recommendation. We missed that.
Section 2 of the bill says the bill takes, July 1st, 2006.
Yeah, I would like it to be July 1st, 2005.
I assume, isn't there some time implementation issues in terms
of
the election?
Yes, I'm sure that some of the signs will not get up in time for that.
Okay.
But that will solve the problem for the drivers. That will be the law.
Okay.
And we have signs out there right now that are not in sync with the law as it is.
All right.
So
I'm just a little concerned if I start opening the bill to amendments, there might be other kinds of
amendments. On the other hand, I like the bill as written. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ditto.
Okay. All right.
And that's why we got up so early to come in today.
All right.
We all agree.
Thank you all very much. We appreciate you joining us. Next up, Mr. John Oshel, Troy Costales from ODOT. And then I've got on deck Mark Landauer and Mark Lear.
Did you want to start, Troy?
Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales, manager of the Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And actually, given your discussion with the panel preceding us, first of all, I appreciate the acknowledgement of ODOT's efforts on state highways to already start working towards some of the resolutions here. I basically would say I am open to questions or try to help clarify any of the issues that you may have in relationship to the bill as is delivered to you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, John Oshel. I pronounce it two ways myself, so don't worry about it. Speaking in behalf of the road officials who have to put up all the signing and so forth, first, strongest statement, we agree with this compromise solution and think it is a good solution and strongly support it. It is a compromise. There's little tweaks that individuals don't like. I would comment that I attended all, basically, four hearings that have happened in the building on this. Well, three in the building and one in Bend, and, of course, one was on the Senate side. My general perception of it is the traffic officials are all over the map on this issue, but the public is quite consistent. They were very upset about the hours being way too extensive, and they were very upset about the inconsistencies. This bill works most of those issues. There's still a little bit of an inconsistency having to do when, what a school day is, but my perception is that will be a few weeks at the beginning and the ending of the school year, but it avoids the problem of having a school zone set up all summer, which the public will not appreciate. Relating to the implementation time on it, we had been asked, could we have the signs change in time for the school year? At the county level, we can. I've checked with the road officials on that. I will acknowledge the cities probably have greater problems. I would suggest that even if you don't choose to change the implementation date, that I will be making recommendations to all of my road officials that under current law, we could change them and make them all 7 to 5 under the current law. And so basically I would be recommending we work ourselves towards consistency even if the implementation date is later.
Okay. Thank you.
And other than that, open to questions.
All right. Ms. Munson.
Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee. Christy Munson for the League of Oregon Cities. Just 5 points to make today. First, we're neutral on the substantive portions of the bill. That is because, like this body, my elected officials, police chiefs, and traffic engineers could not come to a consensus on some of the time zones and whether the road should be adjacent or not. But there are some points that we do have positions on. First, that this body recognized that every time we change this law, there are significant costs to local government, which means cost to your taxpayers. So if we could somehow solve it, if not once and for all, for the next 10 years, we'd very much appreciate that.
Two, flashing lights trump all. You've heard that already. That's very important to us. That allows our schools some local control. Do want you to know that control of the flashing lights and purchase of the flashing lights is not done by the school district. It's done by cities in partnership with school districts. And our best estimates of those flashing lights, per flashing lights, $8,000 to $12,000 a pop. Those are our best estimates. I've heard there are less expensive ways to do it, but it's a costly solution, but it's a good one. The delayed effective date is very important to cities so that we can have some time to get signs made. Last time we had a backlog of signs and our sign makers. I don't know. And lastly, thank you for the attention to this issue. We appreciate it, and we appreciated working with the House Committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions for this panel? Sarah Ringo.
Thank you. Well, Christy, how do you see the flashing lights activated? Who do you see turning them on? The school principal?
Senator Brown, Senator Ringo, we don't have the answer for that. I have a feeling that per system it's done differently, but it is done in partnership with the city and the schools. And I think it's done differently throughout the state.
All right. Well, I want some clarification of this. Let's say that the city gives the authority to the schools to activate the yellow light. Do you think that arrangement would work, and then that would allow a principal to go out and activate the yellow lights?
Chair Brown, Senator Ringo, I know that in some school districts and some cities it is done exactly that way. And maybe Mr. Costales has more information, but I have a feeling it has to do with how the thing is wired, how it's set up, what the control systems are, et cetera.
Are they activated locally, or are they activated from a central facility?
I do, Chair Brown, Senator Ringo, I do know that some of them are activated locally, and I do know that it's been difficult for some of our cities to activate them locally, that there is a central system. When you say locally, I guess I need to clarify. Do you mean at the school?
At the school.
I know a lot of them are done that way. I can find out how many in our schools for you.
But it's your understanding some of them can't be activated locally. Some of them, they've got some central switching.
It's my understanding from my discussions with some of my traffic engineers.
Thank you very much.
I drove up to Portland last night and was very aware of the difference I get to use the Ross Island Bridge. So I'm very aware of the traffic differences when we're in school and when we're out. Now that we're out of school, the traffic's down a bit a third. It's a huge difference. It's huge. So anyway, thank you all. We appreciate you being here. Okay. Representative Nelson, I understand you want to testify on House Bill 2840. Why don't you come on up? We've had a very strong panel from the House, so...
Thank you, Chair Brown, and distinguished members and administrator of this committee. Thank you for hearing this bill. I am Representative Donna Nelson, living in the heart of traffic congestion. So we have a lot of heartaches in our area. For over 50 years, we have lived with an obstructive obstacle to the economic viability of our county, Yamhill County. And I'm here today one more time to express our tremendous need for funds to further the Newburgh-Dundee bypass. And we'll certainly appreciate your support of allowing us to use these funds. Twice now I've served on committees that whereby funds were to be designated. It was the legislative intent of the bills we passed to be sure we had funds to further this effort, and neither time has it happened. So we are desperate at this time.
Thank you. And your testimony is on House Bill 3415.
Oh, excuse me. Are we on the speed zone?
Yes.
I beg your pardon. Okay.
That's okay.
I apologize.
That's okay.
Okay, well, that takes care of that one. Sorry. Okay. And on the speed zone, one of the top two issues, if I could
sure,
mention.
Go ahead.
It's one of the top two issues with my constituents, and while safety is our top priority. We find that it is unnecessary to restrict traffic to very low speed zones at times that we do not have children in the vicinity in the neighborhoods of our schools. We will appreciate your consideration of this bill. There. Okay.
Very good.
Thank you.
Any questions for Representative Nelson? Thank you. Representative Hunt, we'll bring you up in about 2 minutes here. I'd like to get the city of Portland up as they face what I would call is an uphill battle at this point.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mark Landauer with the Office of Government Relations. I'll keep my comments very brief. I'll just introduce Mark Lear, who is the city's traffic investigation manager. Thank you.
I know. Chair Brown, for the record, my name is Mark Lear. I'm the traffic investigations manager for the city of Portland. I manage a traffic investigations group in our Safe Routes to School and have a lot of experience with dealing with the issues that have been you've been talking about today, one of those being how we time signal or flashing lights. I can talk about that a little bit too, but we want to thank the hard work of the House in putting this package together, House Bill 2840. We just think that there's two fairly minor changes that would dramatically improve the safety of the legislation. We've done some work this spring in looking at when kids are hit. There's some good national and local data, and what we find out is that only 19% of collisions that are occurring around a school are occurring in those times, the school days, the period of time between, you know, the 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. Unfortunately, it's when kids are unsupervised between 5 p.m. to 7 p.m., which is where we have most of the collisions. And weekends and summer months, we have more collisions than we do at just on regular school days. So the upshot is if you extend the hours from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. and include all days, you will cover 80% of the time of collisions instead of only covering 19% of collisions if you go for the 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. on school days. We've also heard from a number of judges and law enforcement people that we talked to that they're concerned that it's going to be hard to enforce, that they're going to hear people that are saying, you know, this said school days, but, you know, we're getting tickets at other times. So that's another one, a concern we have. We've also done a little bit of analysis that we've included in your pack about travel delay and basically highlighted that the extended length of a trip as a result of going through school zones that are on average about 300 feet is really an extension of your trip of about 2 to 6 seconds. From our perspective, adding that 2 to 6 seconds to a trip to be able to reduce the chance that a child might die from, you know, 10% at 20 miles per hour to 90% chance that they would die at 40 miles per hour is really worth the investment. Just one quick closing thing on flashing beacons. I would agree that flashing beacons, when they're used aggressively and appropriately, probably can be, you know, one of the best tools we have. Our problem, at least from my experience in the city of Portland, is one of the hardest things that we have to do in our group is at the beginning of every school year, we have to contact the school districts and say, tell us the times that you want us to start the flashing lights. We actually have a pager system that we call in to set those up with the light system. And just getting that information is a hard thing to do. We would love to have school districts more actively involved in turning those light switches on and off, but my experience is school districts that are strapped for cash, they don't have enough money to mow their lawns or take their flags down at night, those sort of things that you see sometimes, just have a hard time running the flashing beacons. At the same time, I think you heard from cities that cities, even though they'd like to have flashing beacons and they'd like to have their local government control those in a way that made sense, that they don't have the resources for that as well. So in the short term, until we have the funding for a more aggressive flashing beacon program, I think the simple change of going to the 7 to 7 and all days would, you know, gives you a fourfold more protection for kids in schools. And really, this is all about keeping kids safe, getting more kids to walk to school, and really enjoy and be safe in our communities. Thank you.
Senator Ferrioli.
Yeah, 7 to 7 all days, 365, 7 to 7 all days.
Right.
When you say collision, what do you mean by collision? Is this traffic accidents involving two vehicles near a school, or is this a collision between a child in a crosswalk and a vehicle?
Yeah, the two studies we were looking at were cars hitting kids either walking or bicycling. And when I say near a school, not all just to clarify, not all those were in school zones. They were defined as being within 3 blocks of a school.
I still don't have a clear understanding of whether or not you're trapping children hitting crosswalks or just general traffic accidents around school zones.
Right. We're sorry to not be clear. It's kids being hit by cars when they're walking or biking. They may or may not be in a school zone. They're within three blocks of a school. The data wasn't as complete to say, you know, are they specifically in a school zone? We're extrapolating based on the fact that they're within three blocks of a school.
I think it's pretty vigorous extrapolation.
Thank you, Senator Ferrier.
Sure.
Other questions? Senator Ringo.
Thank you. So explain to me how you activate the flashing yellow lights. Do you anticipate that they're put on a timer that then is controlled centrally, or is there some on-site switch that somebody can use?
The way it works for us is there's actually a pager device that's in all of our flashing beacons, and so someone has to call into that pager device and put some codes in, and, you know, like setting your sprinkler system or something like that. It changes when the flashing lights come on and when they turn off. Right now it's done through our signal office, you know, through our street signal, our operations group. I'm sure in different communities, you know, there's different systems for doing that.
But what you just described, is that manipulating the timing of it, or is it, can it be done on this Saturday morning we happen to have some school fair, so we
right
this Saturday, but only this Saturday?
Yeah, for us in the city of Portland, we've never done flashing beacons for those unique types of activities. We've sort of struggled just to get the information from schools. I mean, it's an odd thing, but when you look at all the different schools, there's so many different times when they start, close, special sessions. It's just been hard to make that work. I mean, I hear what you're saying. It seems like a reasonable thing to do, to have more of a more power in the school's hands to sort of be able to do that, because it's a hard thing for us to coordinate centrally. It might be something to look into.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It just seems for $12,000 a pop, a switch on site wouldn't be that hard to hard to hook up. But thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Lehrer, my recollection, the street that I got the most complaints about was Belmont, and from about 80th on Belmont to 20th on Belmont, right now under current law, there are three different zones.
Right.
There's three different types of school zones, and what people are most frustrated about with is the inconsistency.
Right.
Would you agree with me that the bill at least addressed the inconsistency issue under current statute?
To a degree, it'll help, I think. The problem we're going to have, and we had the amendments we actually had drafted, I think the -6 amendments, actually tried an approach that said, based on the speed of the street, have a consistent speed limit. The problem you have on streets, Belmont Division, a number of those, is you will have six or seven, potentially a number of school zones, four or five school zones, and because some of those are adjacent and non-adjacent, you are going to bounce back and forth. Some of them have beacons, some of them don't. It's still likely with this new proposal that the public's going to say it still feels like a whole bunch of different school zones. And I think that's why with the other amendments that we had drafted, we really felt like if you use the 30-mile-an-hour standard, I mean, the upshot is, I know we talk a lot about ODOT school zones on ODOT facilities, but 85%, I would estimate, to 90% of school zones are inside cities. They're not on state facilities. They're on speeds with streets 30 miles an hour or lower. I mean, my personal sense is, and that's why I drafted amendments, is that the long-term solution to this thing is provide reasonable protection on those 30-mile-per-hour streets, provide flashing beacons on the higher-speed facilities. And that, to me, is the ultimate solution that will have basically two types of conditions and clear this up. I still think with this current bill, we're going to have confusion because there's quite a few different kinds of signs still.
Okay. Any further questions?
Madam Chair.
Sir Ringo.
So you had the -6 amendments drafted? I thought I heard you say that.
I think we were at that let me see. I believe that is correct, Senator Ringo. Well,
Madam Chair, I guess I'd appreciate knowing whether these are under serious consideration. If so, who's going to discuss them?
Well, I'm happy to have a conversation about them during the work session.
Actually, we...
I think you've heard a clear signal from the House, Senator Ringo, that... they are the -5 yours or the -6?
No, Chair Brown, I believe that the amendments that we had requested were the A8s. I don't know if those are in your packet.
Well, okay. Madam Chair, the -6 amendments contemplate refunding money to people who receive tickets, and I just want to know if that is going to be part of the package, who's going to talk about it. And if you're telling me it's not going to be part of the package.
Well, I think you heard a clear message from the House that the difficulty if we do any amendments to the bill, Senator Ringo. But I'm happy to have a conversation about the 5s, the 6s, and the 8s. But we don't have the 8s in front of us.
can get. So,
I don't want to have a conversation just for hypothetical purposes.
All right. Okay.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 284. I'm going to move to House Bill 3415. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3415. We have a very long list of folks that are here. We appreciate all of you being here. But my understanding is there's absolutely no opposition to the bill, so we'd ask that you keep your remarks brief. With that, I will call up the entire Oregon Legislature. Representative Dave Hunt, Representative Kim Thatcher, Senator Rick Metzger, Representative George Gilman, Senator Gary George, I saw, and for the record, Representative Donna Nelson already testified. Good morning. Welcome.
Morning. Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee. Pleasure for us to be here. We appreciate you having this hearing on this very important bill. As I'm Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County, for the record. All of you know well, in 2003 we passed the OTIA 3 transportation package, which was really a key effort on the part of the legislature and the governor to enhance freight mobility in Oregon. The good news has been that as a result of an OSU bridge study subsequent to that passage, we're going to be able to save a significant amount of money off of those bridges, still be able to do all 365 bridges that were outlined, and yet do them a lot more cheaply. House Bill 3415A would allocate the savings from those bridges, which would go 75% to the projects of statewide significance, which you'll hear a lot about today, and 25% for other highway projects that applied for funding under OTIA 3 but were not able to be funded. So two very important goals, very much in keeping with the original goals of House Bill 3415, which is moving freight throughout our communities and throughout our state. This projects of statewide significance, I would call in particular to your attention, the Transportation Commission has already identified these. They've said these are key critical goals to move freight especially, as well as people throughout Oregon, and we need to get them done. The challenge of that list right now is there are not resources identified to do them. This bill would identify some significant resources to get those projects moving forward, and I will defer to my colleagues to speak further about it. I would urge your support.
Senator Metzger, take it away.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll be brief, Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. I don't think it's any it falls any irony upon you that all the legislators here happen to all represent areas of the state, areas of statewide significance. Just really, really, really briefly, as you know, we worked very, very hard on House Bill 2041 in trying to balance the needs of maintenance, preservation, freight mobility, to build out the project's statewide significance as well as repair our bridges. And the Transportation Commission, which represents all areas of the state, has diligently put together a plan to meet all those needs. House Bill 3415 doesn't change any of those priorities, as Representative Hunt has said, but it does say if gee whiz, we can actually save some money. And Chris Higgins, the professor from Oregon State who led this team, who was job shadowed me a few weeks ago, it was fascinating to talk to him about the savings that could be done. This simply applies those to those priorities that had we known that we didn't need as much money for this first level of bridges, I'm absolutely certain we would have allocated some of these monies a little differently. This provides that opportunity. My only other comment, just for the record, don't intend to submit any amendment. I'm not real excited about the word need, where it says the Department of Transportation does not need the money. Sometimes what we need and what is actually required to get the job done is not one and the same thing. So just for the record, certainly the intent of the legislation is if it's not absolutely required to meet the repair requirements, that those monies should be allocated differently. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Thatcher, welcome.
Thank you. Kim Thatcher, representative from Newburgh and Kaiser. And, of course, ever since I came into office, the project that everybody, or the one thing that everybody would tell me about is that we need to get this project built. Do whatever you can. Find some money. Do whatever you need to do policy-wise to work on getting this project built. That's why I'm here today. It's a great opportunity to reallocate those monies. Unless you've driven out 99W from Portland over to the coast on a weekend or just any day after 3, 2, 1, it's getting worse and worse. I mean, it's getting to be an all-day gridlock there, and it's really affecting the towns along that area, and that would include areas outside of my district. And I would say that these are indeed projects of statewide significance. It affects a huge region of our state, and whatever we can do to help facilitate these projects we need to do, and I'll leave it at that.
Representative Gilman, and then Senator George.
Chair Brown, thank you very much. Representative George Gilman, District 55, Chair of the House Transportation Committee. We were not aware that it looked like there'd be savings in this old TIA 3 package when we first came here, but it became more apparent. We still don't know the number. We have no idea whether it's $2 or $500 million. But it's somewhere between those two figures, probably. And we think that there should, though, that no, that amount of money should, we should start to specify what we're going to use it for, and that's what this bill does.
Great. Thank you. Senator George, good morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, State Senator Gary George, representing District 12. Over the past 3 weeks, I've had an opportunity to be in West Northwest Portland. Down there, actually, because I am a CDL licensed truck driver, I had to be down there to pick up a truck, and the traffic was horrible out on Highway 30. And I said, "Well, how do we get over to the other side over there, and in order to access that other part of the industrial section?" And the fellow who was with me, he used to work in that area a few years ago, said, "You don't. We have to go back and go over 405 Bridge, or go clear down and go over the other bridge." The traffic was backed up for 3 or 4 miles. 3 o'clock in the afternoon. That told me right then we have a freight mobility problem in Portland. You just heard mention Highway 99W going through Dundee and Newburgh. It's just an amazing place of absolute cars stopped, and they're stopped for hours. I also had an opportunity to be on the Oregon coast, and what did I see down there? Roads in the middle of Lincoln City that literally are completely broken down, and those roads need to be repaved, and there needs to be improvement. We need ties in that region, you know, allowing for the four lanes that exist in pieces along there to be connected by adding the additional lanes where it's two lanes now, a four lanes, two lanes scenario. So no matter where you go in the state, particularly on the coast and the valley, we have two problems. First of all, just moving the public, and secondly, being able to move heavy trucks and transportation issues. I pull one trailer that's a 45-footer, and one of the things I've noticed is that most of our turns on our state highways have not been appropriately updated to handle the length of the new trailers that are out there running. What we're seeing here, and I'm going to give you the example of why I think there may be savings. Just recently, in fact, over the weekend, a bridge in Falls City was torn down because we had the brand new replacement bridge. The sad news is, according to the county commissioners, that bridge that was torn down was probably as structurally sound as the brand new bridge. Now, that means we probably should look more carefully before we replace it, and particularly before we weight limited that bridge, which had a significant impact on the economy out there when we weight limited it. So we have great information that's been developed by OSU and the engineering department. We figured out ways now that we can structurally improve these bridges without tearing them down or rebuilding them. I believe there's going to be significant savings. And when this program came through my committee in Ways and Means last session, the one thought I had is, let's get some dollars out for roadway and for additional provision for freight mobility. So with that, urge your support for this bill. I think it's probably one of the most important things that we'll do for Oregon's economy. Thanks.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Now the former legislators, former Representative Leslie Lewis, come on up. Former Senator Bill Kennemer, come on up. Art Schlack, why don't you come on up? And Jeff Bennett, Chair of the Clackamas County Economic Development Commission. First? Okay.
All right. Good morning, Chair Brown, committee members. It's a real pleasure to be here this morning. I am Leslie Lewis. I'm currently a Yamhill County Commissioner. Formerly, as Chair Brown stated, served in the House of Representatives with Chair Brown and now Senator Atkinson. So it's my pleasure to be here this morning, and I'm not going to repeat everything that's been said by everyone. In fact, I will turn in some testimony. But I think the critical thing about House Bill 3415 is that it would, in fact, help move some projects that are considered by the Oregon Transportation Commission as projects of statewide significance. As you've already heard from the two legislators from my area, and I guess Representative Nelson as well, we have one of those projects in Yamhill County. It's called the Newburgh-Dundee Bypass, and currently it has receive some state funding, but far short of the dollars that are needed to build this project. Right-of-way is being developed both in Newburg and Dundee. We have a corridor selected for the project. We are the final EIS is being published in the Federal Registry. We should have a record decision. But while we have no funds, currently very few funds to buy right-of-way, that right-of-way is being eaten up by building because we cannot really stop people from using their property as they as it is currently zoned. We feel that the dollars available potentially from excess bridge monies, and the director has told us that determinations will be made probably within the next 6 to 8 months on how much excess dollars they might have. Those dollars could start helping these projects of statewide significance, both Newburgh-Dundee, Sunrise Corridor, the I-5 to 99 connector in Washington County, projects in southern Oregon. So I would urge your support of this bill. All of these projects obviously help move freight as well. You'll see in my testimony that we have a freight truck every 20 seconds in the town of Newburgh. So we have a significant amount of freight using Highway 99. I would also like to mention that the Newburgh-Dundee bypass, as well as the Sunrise Corridor, have been chosen by the Oregon Transportation Commission as projects to move forward into the innovative public-private partnership. And while we are very encouraged by the private sector interest in our project, we know that more public funding will be needed to move these projects ahead. So, Madam Chair, if there aren't any questions, that would conclude my testimony.
Thank you. Commissioner Kanemer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, it's nice to be with you this morning. Thank you for the courtesy. Also, for the record, I'd like to note that we have a letter which is going to be distributed to you from Washington County expressing their support for this program, and also a letter from the Oregon Home Builders Association expressing their support. I'll make my remarks very brief. I think you already understand the nature of what brings us to this point. With the potential of additional money being available, highways of statewide significance and freight corridors become central for funding and are long overdue. These will have huge financial impacts for us. And, of course, in Clackamas County, we're interested in getting underway with a project that we've considered for 17 years. Part of the urgency is that the metro growth the urban growth boundary in Portland has been expanded to include about 12,000 acres in the Damascus area. We're anticipating growth just in that community and or that area of 60 to 90,000 new people in the next 20 years and 45 to 75,000 new jobs and 25,000 housing units. That's not to include all of the regional impacts as people head off to Mount Hood and to Central and Eastern Oregon. Sunrise Corridor, and 212, which is the highway it will replace, already is over capacity at about 59,000 vehicles today. I-205 and 212 is the second busiest intersection in the state. So I think you can see why we're eager to move forward with funding. We brought three people from our business community who would like to make brief remarks. I thank you for your time. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions? No? Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Jeff Bennett. I'm the chair of the Clackamas County Economic Development Commission, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you this morning. As you probably know, the Oregon Transportation Commission just recently designated the Clackamas County Sunrise Corridor as one of seven highways of statewide significance. That highway will create a significant link between the heart of the Portland metropolitan region and eastern Oregon. And that designation also reinforces the longstanding local and regional decisions that Commissioner Kanemer just spoke about. The Sunrise Corridor also will be very important to the long-term viability of the Clackamas industrial area, so it's very important to Clackamas County that this that the decision made by the Oregon Transportation Commission be placed in a priority by this committee. Since its original adoption, the county's economic development plan has identified the Sunrise Corridor as the crown jewel facility to achieve three different objectives. The first is that it will improve our urban, industrial, and commercial transportation system. The second is that it will enhance our ability to retain our existing industrial and commercial employment base. And finally, it will enhance our ability to attract and capture new business that is looking to locate in Clackamas County. There will also be significant regional and statewide benefits that I spoke of earlier. The corridor will create a new, efficient commercial transit corridor that will connect Interstate 205 to Highway 26, which will significantly reduce the amount of time it takes freight to move from the Portland regional area to eastern Oregon. The Clackamas County Economic Development Commission urges that you pass House Bill 3415, and we thank you for the opportunity to testify. If you have any questions for me, I'd be happy to answer them for you now.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Any questions? Hearing seeing none.
Vice Chair, yes, thank you, sir. Vice Chair Ferrioli and members of the committee, Art Slack with the Association of Oregon Counties. I have written testimony that is being handed out to you. I would just like to add that the Association of Oregon Counties believes that the funding of the projects identified by the Oregon Transportation Commission as projects of statewide significance is of importance to all portions of the state of Oregon at this point. And that putting any savings from the OTIA 3 state bridge program towards these projects is of major importance to further those projects to help economic development and move commerce in the state of Oregon. So we would ask for your support of 3415A. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We would like to call Mr. Tucker, Greg DeGrazia, and Will DeParks, please. Welcome, Ms. Parks. Can we begin with you?
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Ferrioli, members of the committee. As the CEO of the North Clackamas County Chamber of Commerce,
your name for the record,
I'm sorry, thank you very much, Will DeParks, and the President and Chief Executive Officer of the North Clackamas County Chamber of Commerce. And I'd like you to know that in addition to my written testimony, I'm going to point out a couple of things. Our Chamber of Commerce is a regional Chamber of Commerce that has 620 members that includes 16,000, over 16,000 employees. We cover a very large portion of Clackamas County, which in fact includes about 170,000 of the residents of Clackamas County and includes the infamous corner of Highway 205 and 212, 224. We believe that passage of this bill will assist in the safety for the state of Oregon and economic growth not only for our region but for the entire state of Oregon. And with that, we would say that this is the time and the opportunity, and that we hope that the legislature is wise enough at this point to pass this forward and help us increase the viability of the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Parks. Questions? Mr. DeGrazia.
Thank you, Vice Chair Ferrioli and members of the committee. My name is Greg DeGrazia. I'm a member of the North Clackamas Chamber County, North Clackamas County Chamber of Commerce, and also their liaison for the Public Advisory Committee for the Sunrise Corridor. Written testimony has been passed out to you, so I'll be very brief. I just want to extend and reiterate the Chamber's support of House Bill 3415. I appreciate your consideration of it. The funds that could be used, left over and passed on to the projects of statewide significance will be very helpful in expanding the growth in the Clackamas County area, which is expected to be happening in the next several years. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Mr. Tucker.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. If I take more than a minute, cut off my microphone. I am here mainly to distribute... The laughing doesn't count. I'm here mainly to distribute to you a letter that was distributed throughout the legislature a few weeks ago that urges the legislature over the next couple of years to address long-term comprehensive transportation funding needs of the state. However, if you note on the back of the letter itself, page 2 of the letter, JPAC, the Joint Policy Advisory Committee on Transportation, which represents the Portland region on transportation policy, has urged a passage of House Bill 3415.
No.
I don't know if I made it or not, but I can stop there if you like.
Right. Any questions for this panel?
You did really good.
I'm impressed. Ms. Parks, I just wanted to say thanks for joining us this morning, and I received numerous letters from the North Clackamas Chamber of Commerce, so I appreciate your hard lobbying efforts. So.
Thank you. I appreciate that comment, Senator Brown. And so you can see how important this is to the region, to our economic area, and to the entire state of Oregon.
Thank you. If you stick around a few minutes, you might actually see us do something around here for a change. So, okay, anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 3415? Okay, close the public hearing, House Bill 3415. Any amendments?
No.
No amendments. Open a work session, House Bill 3415. Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none, so ordered. Senator Metzger can carry that bill on the Senate floor. Thank you all very much for being here. Let's go back to our little transportation bill. Okay. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2840. I removed the amendments. I've had numerous conversations with House members. I'm extremely concerned if we make any changes that this bill, which I think is in reasonably good shape, is going to die. With that, the chair would move the House Bill 2840 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none, so ordered. Senator Atkinson, you wish to carry? Okay. All right. I want to go back. Let's see if we can find Ms. McPeak. So I'm going to open a work session on the Commission for Women Appointments. We have a number. I just love this process. I've received three new phone numbers from Ms. McPeak. So, okay. Okay. I was going to try and move the 3179.
Hello.
Hi, is this Ms. McPeak?
It is.
Good morning. This is State Senator Kate Brown, and I have you on a very loud speakerphone, and you're being piped throughout the Capitol, so good morning.
Good morning.
I have at the dais with me Senator Atkinson and Senator Farioli. Are you having a good time in Ashland?
We are indeed. We always do.
Good. And you're staying at a fabulous hotel. We would just like to hear a little bit about your background and why you would like to serve on this particular commission.
I'd be happy to. First of all, I apologize for being difficult to reach, but here we are at last.
No problem.
I did send in a very brief resume. Do you have that?
We do have that, yes.
All right. Well, if it's all right, I won't repeat that information. At the end, I have a few remarks. They won't go on too long. And then please ask me any questions that I don't cover.
Thank you.
I appreciate your considering my appointment for the Oregon Commission for Women, and I'm very honored that the governor has appointed me, and I hope, of course, that you will confirm that appointment. I won't repeat, as I said, the information in my background statement. Rather, I'd like this morning to tell you why I think serving on the Commission for Women would be important. Can you hear me well enough?
Yep, you're fine.
All right. I applied to join the commission because the status of women in Oregon matters. It matters to Oregon's women, but it also matters to the families those women are a part of and to the rest of us. If women attain lower levels of education than their abilities warrant, if they have higher unemployment rates, if they earn less when they are employed, then those failures affect many people. The fact that women in some other countries are in far worse situations, as we see in places like Afghanistan, of course doesn't excuse our failures. Let's look at a few of the ways we can measure the gap between where Oregon's women are and where they might be. None of the things I'm going to mention will be new to any of you, but they'll show you what I think are important things. I was trained as an economist, and I believe that low income can explain many of the difficulties that all people might have. For women, in 2000, Oregon women who worked at full-time, year-round jobs earned median incomes of $27,000, while men at the same time earned $37,000. And I'm going to have a sip of water.
Okay.
In the 1990s, Oregon's working women, and close to 60% of them are in the labor force, earned 76.3% as much per hour as men. For women of color, of course, the difference is even greater. Almost 26% of households headed by women were below the poverty level in Oregon in 1999. If those same families included children under the age of 5, the percent below the poverty level rose to more than 47%. For women, the strong correlation between educational achievement and income earned can be a key to getting out of poverty or remaining there. The sad news is that Oregon ranked at the bottom of the 5 western states in the percentage of women with 4 or more years of college in 1990. We've probably improved that situation since then, but we need to do even better. Generally, of course, the rising tide of prosperity lifts all boats. Recession has the opposite effect, of course, and women tend to be hit harder than men in less prosperous times. We've been struggling with a recession now for several years. This March, our unemployment rate was 6.1%. The high rate was 8.5% in the summer of 2003, but we're not yet back to the low rate we had in the spring of 95 when the rate was down to 4.7. Of course, state revenues tighten just when people need more assistance. We agree as a state that when revenues get tight, education must be a high priority. It's certainly an important factor in women's ability to succeed in the workplace. I focused the last couple of minutes on the economic and educational challenges that seriously impact women and children in Oregon. But I've lived long enough and known enough women to realize none of these challenges are easy, even when dollars are abundant. I've seen many women whose self-confidence was so weak that a divorce or the death of a husband has left them unable to cope, even if they have a middle-class income and a college degree. That is a problem that is slowly being solved by the different world view of many younger women. The Commission for Women can promote a sense of possibility and confidence to women in Oregon through the interaction occurring at meetings, the Woman of Achievement Award, citizen referrals, legislative advocacy, and health and financial wellness forums. Some of these activities have, of course, been curtailed by state funding problems, but there are now private fundraising mechanisms in place to try to revive them. While the Commission's work is limited when state funding is limited, I believe we can still work to make our programs more effective and get more bang for those limited bucks. We need to make sure that the women in Oregon know what programs are available to help them, whether in health, education, or assistance in getting their families fed and clothed. The Oregon Commission for Women can help pass on that information in ways women can use. When you consider new legislation, the Commission can help inform you about the problems women are dealing with so you can make better choices. The women of Oregon, our wives, sisters, mothers, daughters, should have every opportunity to realize their potential and then make their own choices about what they do with their talents. we as a state should all do all we can afford to do to help them in that goal. How can these challenges be met by my participation in the work of the Oregon Commission for Women? I don't presume that I will make a huge difference, but I do know I will use whatever talent and wisdom I have to add to the effectiveness of the Commission. I'd like to participate in that effort. Thank you for listening to me, and as I say, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Ms. McPeak. I really appreciated the information you provided us. I think there are no questions for you at this time. What I would say to you is that we may be needing you. As you probably know, the advocacy commissions are really struggling for funding this session. I anticipate we'll be able to move a bill out of the Senate that will combine some of the administrative functions of the advocacy commissions, and we'll be able to move that over to the House. We're probably going to need letters and phone calls from folks on the commission and folks interested in the commission's work in order to pass that bill on the House side. So thank you very much. We really appreciate your time and energy. I appreciate your willingness to serve the state, and we certainly appreciate your family's willingness to serve our country. So
thank you so much, Senator Brown, and the rest of you.
And enjoy your trip in Ashland.
We will.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Close public hearing. I'm going to open a public hearing. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2174. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us a little bit about the bill?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. House Bill 2174A is an overhaul of statutes authorizing and directing use of the Special Public Works Fund.
Okay, I've got Mr. Whitney, Ms. Pruitt. Why don't you two come on up? And could you please go get Representative Vakian? Thank you. Got it. Okay. Good morning. Thanks for your patience. We had a number of bills to get through this morning. Good.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Gary Whitney. I'm a policy and program coordinator for the Economic and Community Development Department. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before the committee this morning and express the department's support for House Bill 2174. The primary purpose of House Bill 2174 is to reorganize and streamline the statutes for the Special Public Works Fund program. Special Public Works Fund the program's authorities are largely unchanged. The Special Public Works Fund is primarily a revolving loan fund program. It's currently valued at about $145 million, and it provides financing for municipally owned infrastructure and facilities. So the program finances projects that are sponsored by Oregon municipalities. Municipalities can include cities, counties, or districts, selected special districts, tribal councils, and others. The financing that we provide is for planning, design, and construction of the municipal facilities. In this case, the facilities include locally owned roads, water, sewer, stormwater systems, telecommunication facilities, the kinds of things that municipalities need to grow their industrial sites and their communities. The program was created by the legislature in 1985, so it's 20 years old. The original program didn't have many of the features of the current program, and it's been, I guess I'd use the word, added to and supplemented and over the years to increase the program's authorities and its reach. For example, about 10 years ago, the program started using lottery bond proceeds to capitalize the fund, where originally we just used lottery proceeds. About 6 years ago, the legislature added a whole new project type to the types of projects that could be funded, and that was a community facility project, which was essentially a community building, a community purpose building. And most recently, the legislature enhanced the program's ability to support municipalities in the event of a natural disaster, allowing up to $2.5 million in grant funds to be used as in match for federal disaster funds. So the result of these changes as the program has grown is to create a statute that's a little bit hard to interpret and can be seen as somewhat contradictory. So in an effort to get to a simpler statute that is easier for our stakeholders as well as ourselves to use, we're proposing to reorganize the statutes. You may have questions about the 10 statutes that are proposed to be repealed, but it's important to note that in many cases the exact language, and in almost all cases at least the intent of the statute that's being repealed, is being carried over into other areas of the statute. So we aren't diminishing the program's authorities by repealing those 10 statutes. There are some additions to the program, but before I talk about those, I'd like to talk about the streamlining and the efficiency that we are proposing. First and most importantly, I mentioned that the legislature added community facility type projects about 6 years ago. So we're proposing now to combine the two types of eligible projects under the fund, the infrastructure project and the community facility project, and combine those under a single definition so that a municipality won't have to wonder if it's making an application for the right type of project. It can come in under the development project umbrella and know that its project is eligible. We're also doing the same with the planning projects. Instead of having two types of eligible planning projects, we're suggesting to combine those definitions into a single planning project type. We think this will make it a lot easier for municipalities to understand and use. Another thing that we're doing is to expand the emergency provision that I mentioned earlier, where we want to be able to include critical transportation and water and sewer systems in our assistance for natural disasters. The key changes where we are changing the program statutes is we are suggesting to add airport districts as an eligible municipality. There's only one in the state right now, but we see them as being very important for municipal airport development in the future, and we'd like to be able to assist with that. We're proposing to add navigation improvement projects to help ports keep their channels open and safe. And we're proposing to allow purchases for bare land when the municipality will need that for future economic development or job creation purposes. So those are the major enhancements that we are suggesting. Most of it is to do with reorganization and retaining the program's original and still valid focus on job creation and economic development. Oregon has an inadequate inventory of industrial lands in the state, and this program is a major tool to help municipalities address that need.
Thank you. Representative Avakian, Senator Monis Anderson, can you guys hang on for a few minutes? So I have Ms. Okay. Ms. Pruitt, go ahead.
Chair, I would actually like to defer my comments until they've had a chance to testify.
All right, well, that makes it easy. Come on up, you two. Good morning.
I will. Thank you, Madam Chair. You have Representative Brad Avakian in Northeast Washington County. You have being handed to you now -8 amendments. We're fully supportive of House Bill 2174 as it is. The amendment does not change the substance of it, but adds something to 2174. You've got a lot of pages in front of you. The critical one really is page 11. What page 11 does, and which is the crux for the amendment, is it adds to the definition of a business development project, art, culturist, or tourist facilities. The need being that many communities around the state, Gresham and Beaverton in particular, are in the process of trying to develop performing arts centers or other type of cultural centers. Much testimony was given to my budget and earlier the Ways and Means Committee by the department on the importance of arts and cultural centers as economic centers and as community development centers. This just opens up another tool for cities to enhance their economic development by getting some help in building these types of cultural and artistic centers for themselves.
Thank you. Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Senator Lori Moniz Anderson from Gresham and represent Troutdale, Fairview, and Wood Village. Representative Lim and I have been strong proponents of the Gresham Center for Arts, and I handed out to you a document that shows what we have been working on. This has been on our agenda for many, many years, but as you know, cities don't have money, and we do not have ways to build these facilities. We've been a quiet farming community. We are now the fourth largest city, and we do need to have a center for arts. Growing up, we relied on our wonderful, and Reynolds, Gresham, and Centennial High Schools have wonderful music and drama programs, as well as Mount Hood Community College. But we need something more than that, and we have 20 cultural organizations in the East Metro community, and there's a strong need for a center for arts. The advantage of building a center, it builds community, it fosters, believe it or not, creativity, and it encourages economic development. Now, Gresham is located between Mount Hood and Portland, and believe it or not, if we want to get any real good culture, we go to Portland, and many people don't. Right now, we have the Mount Hood Jazz Festival, and that brings people worldwide to that. This year, the first weekend in August, we will be offering it free to the community just because it brings so many people to Gresham, and it is an economic development issue for us also. We do need to, I think, open up the definition. We've done that with a sports park in Gresham, and the sports park has been solely built on volunteer and donations. And if we could add the Center for Arts to this definition, we know that this would help many areas like Beaverton and Gresham, but also other communities statewide. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the legislators. Did you talk with the proponents of the bill before drafting this amendment? Have you had those conversations?
I haven't talked with the two that are sitting at the table, but I did talk with the new interim director and with the governor's office. I would want to add, too, we're sensitive to the fact that this is a new addition to this definition and that there are some wrinkles that are going to need to be smoothed out in the application process and helping the department to implement this. We simply want to make sure that we get the language in the bill so that we can start doing that planning.
Okay. Ms. Pruitt. And I know I have four more people signed up to testify on this bill. We're not going to be able to move the bill today. I'd like folks to make sure that everybody is okay with amendments, and we'll probably bring it back next week. But Mr. Dewey, Mr. O'Connor, Ms. Penwell, Mr. Brandenburg, you guys are pretty much in the building regularly and come back next week. Okay, thank you. All right, Ms. Pruitt.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Victoria Pruitt, for the record, and I'm with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. The department strongly supports infrastructure projects in the community and those that create jobs and arts and cultural facilities that meet those goals, which are what we're tasked by. And the department has actually reviewed the amendments and had that opportunity. And just a few things for consideration. We're actually neutral on it at this point in time, and just some things for the committee to consider. The addition of the language does open up the application to broad interpretation, and that's something that would need to be defined and looked at fairly seriously. For example, for certain revolving loan funds, our definition is that businesses that will result in or will aid or promote cultural and art facilities is actually in there. That could be a McDonald's down the street from the Shakespearean Festival. Is that something that we want to be able to be supporting? Currently, that's not within our definitions, and that's not what we're tasked with. It's all geared primarily towards traded sector and other community tasks. So that's just an example. Secondly, many art, cultural, and tourism-based businesses are nonprofits. We also have in statute and as part of our task and role that certain nonprofits cannot meet, compete with for-profit businesses, depending on the segment in the traded sector. So it's all definitions where we would be opening it up to broad interpretation. And then lastly, many art, cultural, and tourism facilities are currently covered under some of the programs that we have, depending on the definition. And to give you a couple examples of those, currently under revolving loan programs, there has to be property there or something that can service the debt. So if it's an event or something where it's a new structure and there isn't something that could be used as collateral, that would be a new definition and a new consideration for what our programs could do. Certain ones that have currently been covered that fit under either arts manufacturing, which are covered under certain programs, or significant tourism programs, which either are significant tourism has to be a national or international reach. Shakespearean Festival would be one of those. We've actually done a loan to Wildlife Safari, so that has been covered. So something that is significant to an area that draws from beyond our bounds. We've also done loans for Willamette Stern Wheeler, different waterways projects where it's geared towards economic development and jobs as well, trying to tie into our mission but also support what we're tasked with. And then other projects that could potentially be eligible currently in, under statute and under our programs would be an example, the Shakespearean Theater, the Enchanted Forest, down the road would be one as well. The Oregon Coast Aquarium could potentially apply and receive loans and funding under our current definition. So those three things are based for consideration of the committee as we look at the amendments and go forward.
All right. Thank you very much. At this time, I'm going to close the public hearing. I'd sure like folks from OECD to sit down and meet with legislators and see if we can't get their concerns addressed, and at the same time, obviously, concerned. Nothing against McDonald's, but not sure we want state dollars to help out McDonald's. So make sure we can get things narrowed so everyone's okay. All right. Thank you very much. Close public hearing on House Bill 2174. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2537. Chair has no intention of moving the contents of this bill. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2537. And with the exception of, do we have Ms. Green still available? 3179?
Yeah, I've got someone
on the phone. Okay, all right. You know what? Why don't you call him? I'm not going to open a public hearing on 3179. Feel like we need more than 5 minutes to go through that bill. So if you would call our good professor, we can deal with that issue later. Mm-hmm. I'm going to open a hearing on the Oregon Commission for the Blind, see if we can get a hold of Ms. Green. Is anybody here on 3179? You are? Okay. 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 All right.
This is 2346722. Please leave a message and I'll return.
Ms. Green, this is State Senator Kate Brown calling. I'm sorry we missed you. You've had a terribly crazy schedule this morning, and we'll try and get you scheduled for another time. Hopefully we can get you set for a time certain so you know when to expect our call. Thank you very much, Ms. Green. Take care. Okay. Any other business? Do we have any bill introductions? Don't. Okay. I think we're safe. All right. With that, we're adjourned. We'll see you all on the Senate floor. Thanks, you guys. All right.
of the meeting.